From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Tom Santopietro returns this week. His previous books, all wonderful, Considering Doris Day, The Importance of Being Barbara, The Brilliant Tumultuous Career of Barbara Streisand, and Sinatra in Hollywood, are all available for your e-reader as well as your bookshelf. And his new book, and his most personal, I think, is called The Godfather Effect, Changing Hollywood, America, and Me. The me is right here. Tom Santopietro, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me on very much, Gary.
So why did you want to write about the effects of The Godfather? A lot of Italian Americans protested the film in 1972, if I recall.
They did, and the biggest reason I wanted to write about it is because I think any film that 40 years later is still a worldwide obsession, as this one is, just pronounced President Obama's favorite film of all time, I thought that's worth examining.
Well, wouldn't you say Star Wars has his equal, it's just as famous and just also from the 70s, that's why I think of Star Wars. Why do you think The Godfather has more of an effect than, say, Star Wars?
Well, I think basically because it's a much more personal film, and it's about recognizable people in the 20th and 21st century. For all the brilliance of Star Wars, these are archetypes we're watching on the screen. But with The Godfather, it deals so strongly with American mythology and the idea of the American dream and the immigrant journey, which all of us as Americans relate to, not just Italian Americans. And that's why I think it is really unique in that way.
Well, I enjoyed your book a lot. I thought it was wonderful. Tell me about the idea of putting me in it. And I don't mean me, I mean you.
Well, you know, I did not start out that way. As Arthur Lawrence said, that extraordinary writer for the theater, he said, whatever you sit down to write, be assured that something very different is going to come out. And that that is exactly what happened with me. I wanted to write about The Godfather because I loved the films, and I thought, oh, there's such great stories about the making of the films. And that led me into, I started asking myself, well, how did the mob come into existence? And I started doing research about the origins in Italy. And then that made me think about the immigrant journey to the America exemplified by my own grandfather. And as I thought about my grandfather, I realized I needed to put myself into this book, because the key for me with The Godfather was when I saw the sequence in Godfather Part II and I saw my grandfather on the screen. It was really extraordinary. It was actually a life-changing moment, and that's not hyperbole. And I thought, then I have to talk about my life as an Italian-American who grew up in a really WASPy way.
Right. I mean, I've known you for a while now, and other than the fact that you have an Italian surname, you didn't strike me as any more Italian than Chico Marx. So you've kind of discovered more of your own Italianness in the context of writing this book?
Oh, no question about it. And I think to go back to the reference to Godfather 2 is 10 minutes into the movie when you see young Vito, Don Vito Corleone, is a 10-year-old coming to the country for the first time, and he's on board the ship, and it passes in front of the Statue of Liberty, and you see this reverent expression on everyone's face. And all of a sudden, I saw my grandfather, because he was 13, coming to this country alone with 20 lira in his pockets and no English. And you see, that's the first time, the family stories hadn't touched me, but when I saw that visual, I got what my grandfather had gone through. And that made me feel very Italian, and yet throughout my entire life, people have always made these jokes about how I'm the least Italian they know. And I thought, well, then there are stereotypes going on there. Let me look at those.
Yeah. And one of the things I loved about your book was the effect that The Godfather had on the mob, that a lot of the things that criminals do, they do because they saw it in The Godfather?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole business of kissing men on each cheek and the paying homage to the Godfather, you know, kissing his hand, which happens at the end when they're kissing Michael's hand. And all of the phrases, of course, I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse. That had literally started to be said by real life mobsters, and it's on law enforcement tapes. And so there's Mario Puzo inventing the term The Godfather for the novel, and now the term The Godfather is used both by the mobsters themselves and by the FBI.
The Godfather is, and let's talk about the movie for now, we'll talk about the book in a little bit, but the movie, it's a gangster picture, but why is it different from Little Caesar and Public Enemy and Scarface?
Well, I think there are two aspects to that. I think for the first time, you were seeing fully realized, recognizable human beings on the screen. They may have been mobsters, but you understood who these people were. You understood their family life. There was nothing stereotypical about them. And it was the revolutionary aspect of it, just as a film is, it was the first major film about Italians made by Italians. And, you know, all of the previous mobster films had basically been written and directed by Jewish men, directors, and the Jewish men who ran the studios. And Robert Evans talked about that, who was a Paramount exec at the time. And he very smartly insisted upon Coppola. And the story I tell always, where, you know, Stephen Sondheim says God is in the details. Well, the detail with The Godfather is that only Francis Ford Coppola would have said, when it came time to shoot the sequence where Don Vito dies in the garden playing with his grandson, only Coppola would have said, plant that garden with Italian plum tomatoes.
That realism that nobody else would know is what...
Nobody else would have known that, but he had to have that. Yeah, and so to answer your questions, I mean, it's all those details that made it authentic about Italian-American life. And it just, if you watch The Godfather and then you see the mob films that had preceded it, you are watching two entirely different universes.
Well, the movies are great. I love The Godfather, and I remember when I saw it in the theater. I saw them all in the theater. When I saw it in the theater in 1972, and the tension, and then the kind of the realization that I was rooting for killers, it's kind of an odd feeling. I love them, and yet they're the bad guys. Why do I love them so? And the feelings you have when Sonny goes through the turns, what do you call it, the toll booth, and
right.
All the things that happen in the movie. And then, you know, part two also, as you point out in your book, you know, the only sequel, I think, in history that's not only as good as the original, but surpasses the original in its complexity and quality. And it's even a little bit longer, I believe, than the original.
Yes. But, and I think, for me, part two is the masterpiece. I of course, have seen it countless times, and it just grows richer every time I see it. And I think, as you said, it's the first time there's ever been, you know, we're nowadays, unfortunately, we're used to Transformers Part 2 and 3.
Right.
But to see The Godfather Part 2 and to realize Coppola was telling a new story. And the richness, of course, of those first two films is he's showing the mobsters, and as you said, you feel an affection for them. And yet he is pointing out very deliberately, he's using the mob as a metaphor for American big business running out of control and all the parallels between the mob and big business. And if you look at these films in the year 2012 with our knowledge of the financial crisis and what has happened in this country, the films are more relevant than they ever were before.
And apparently, I've discovered when I was reading your book, there's a part three. No, I knew there was. I knew there was a part three, and I didn't like it. I saw it. I've only seen it once when I saw it in the theater, and you know the screen went dark and that music came on and I was so ready.
Right.
And then, you know, then I hated it. And and the things that I hated about it, you know, now I can hardly remember, but I just remember thinking, I'm just going to pretend this movie never was made because I don't like it. And Duvall is not in it, and instead of having Michael be the, you know, the continuation of the story, there's new characters introduced, and there's some bad acting. But you have a different take on part three.
I'm a little more generous than most people are. In fact, I'm probably a lot more generous than people are. And maybe a little bit of that is the contrary streak in me, which I certainly acknowledge. But I think, look, there are a couple of things. Where the film really falls down is that the plot, the financial machinations are way too complicated. And the second reason is, unfortunately, the performance of Sofia Coppola. She's not an actress. She happens to be an extremely talented director, but she's not comfortable in front of the camera. So, and that character of Michael's daughter figures a lot. So the movie kind of comes to a halt every time, you know, it's centering around her, and then it motors up again. My biggest point about part three is that, just as you said, everybody compares it to the first two and says, oh, it's terrible. If you take it on your on its own terms without just comparing it, it's pretty good. There are some spectacular sequences, particularly at the end when they're trying to assassinate Michael in the opera house at the same time that his sister Connie is serving poison-laced cannolis to Don Altobello. And, of course, I love that stuff. So you have to at least look at parts of it again.
All right, I will.
All right.
I'll go home and watch it. Hang on. No. I'll watch it later. I do love part one and part two, and I there are so many great performances. And, you know, actually, thinking about the actors who make their names in the two films, including Marlon Brando, because Brando had kind of fallen on hard times motion picture-wise and had made some bad movies before making The Godfather, and then proceeded to make a lot of bad movies after The Godfather. That was really a highlight of his career there. He made Last Tango in Paris, which was great, and then he made, you know, Superman and The Island of Dr. Moreau and some other pieces of crap. And now when we look at even De Niro, you know, what a wonderful actor De Niro was, but now, you know, he's kind of a hack and he appears in a lot of crap. And as you point out in your book, Pacino, you know, he's sort of the, like, latter-day Joan Crawford now. So that was really a highlight for all those people.
Absolutely. I actually think they are the best performances that De Niro and Pacino have ever given. Pacino in particular is so controlled throughout, and as you were referencing, you know, it's very easy for Al Pacino to veer wildly out of control now. And he, you know, in the first Godfather, of course, he is on screen far, far more than Marlon Brando is.
And he was nominated, if I remember, he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, whereas Brando won the Oscar for Best Actor for the film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is really remarkable. And then De Niro was nominated and won for Best Supporting Actor in Part 2. And it is such a perfectly detailed performance. And you know, I learned in the course of the research that De Niro did not speak any Italian and took intensive language coaching and went to Sicily for research because almost his entire role is in Italian. There are a few words of English thrown in.
I think he says, I'll make him an offer he can't refuse. This is only English.
So it's it's that level of attention to detail, and you know, stardom is a trap for all of these people, and it certainly became a trap for Brando, and that's why it's so great to watch him in this, where he's really calling on all his resources as an actor.
Tell about how Brando was cast.
Well, the interesting thing is that the only people that wanted him were Puzo and Coppola, And while that sounds, well, the two big hitters, it actually, the tough part was that all the powers at Paramount did not want him and actually said, Marlon Brando will never be in the movie. And so what Coppola did was he had to figure out a way to make a screen test of Marlon Brando without Brando knowing it was a screen test. And he told Brando it was a makeup test. And they went to Brando's house, and Brando emerged age 47, a non-Italian with blonde hair. And right before Coppola's eyes, he pulled his hair back. He darkened it with shoe polish. He used shoe polish for a mustache. He started speaking in that guttural voice, figuring that Don Corleone had been shot in the throat earlier in his life, and that's why he spoke that way. And as Coppola said, right there in Brando's own house, he morphed into Don Corleone in front of him.
Did he shove something in his mouth or something to make it, get those jowls that he had?
Yes. He did. I mean, at that point, it was a Kleenex. You know, it became actually a bit of a prosthetic device when it came time to shoot the film. But even there, Brando had, you know, he wanted that so the jaw jutted forward, because he said, Don Corleone looks like a bulldog, but is warm underneath. And so he wanted the jaw like a bulldog. And you know, you asked earlier about the appeal of the film, and it's because there is that warmth underneath.
Duvall, I heard Duvall say once that Brando, you know, he seems like he's acting, he's gazing around the room, he's looking at his lines that are tacked up all around. Is that
That's absolutely true. Well, I was looking at, you know, pictures of the making of, and there are some where you just see Brando, you see the cue cards sort of scattered around the room. You know, Brando, of course, claimed it lent spontaneity to his performance.
He was just too lazy to learn his lines, is the truth.
I actually think it's both. 50-50.
Now, when he played a similar role in the movie The Freshman, I heard that he had a little device in his ear, and somebody just told him his lines right before he said them.
That's exactly right. And he actually talks about that in his autobiography. Mm. And he writes about it, and there's, it's like a two-page explanation of what the delay system was and how he still achieved spontaneity. And I don't know about that, but the thing when he made The Freshman that really interested me was he was on the set, and somebody came over to him and said, Mr. John Gotti would like to see you. Now, that interested me.
That's like a good story there. We're talking with Tom Santapietro, and he wrote a book about Frank Sinatra not too long ago called Sinatra in Hollywood. That's really one of the finest books on Frank, and it is the finest book on Frank as an actor, I would say. And you did work a chapter on Frank Sinatra into your new book.
Well, I felt I had to because, well, of course, there's my continuing obsession with Frank Sinatra, but also he's the most famous Italian-American of them all, and the myth of Sinatra intersects with the myth of the Godfather in so many ways, starting with what everybody knows, how much the character of Johnny Fontaine, the singer-turned-actor, was based on Sinatra. So I thought that's a great taking off point. Then I could talk about the horse's head sequence, which is probably the most famous sequence in the film, and also talk about what Sinatra meant to Italian Americans.
Well, talk a little bit about how much truth there is in the comparison of Johnny Fontaine and Frank Sinatra.
Well, you know, in the film and the novel, Johnny Fontaine is a singer who's turned actor, and he really wants, he needs to make his big comeback. So all of that, of course, exactly parallels Frank Sinatra. There's no question Puzo took the bare bones of Sinatra's life. Where the biggest difference lies is in the fact that when Frank Sinatra made his comeback in From Here to Eternity, it was not the mob getting him the role. There were many reasons for it, his willingness to work so cheaply, the intercession of then-wife Ava Gardner, who had that great quote when she said to the head of Columbia Pictures, listen to me, there's only one guy that can play the role, and it's the SOB I'm married to. Give him the role. and you know, as I say, it's the fact of Sinatra's talent got him the role and made him a star, not the mob. But that being said, you know, all of the career tent poles that you see in Johnny Fontaine, there's no question that was based on Frank.
Right. I mean, Frank was under contract to Tommy Dorsey, and then suddenly he wasn't. Did somebody hold a gun to Tommy Dorsey's head the way Luca Brasi allegedly does to...
Well, I feel not, although, of course, some people prefer the version. And what I think the real thing that happened was that Frank hired an incredibly high-powered and tough lawyer, and it cost Frank Sinatra a huge amount of money to get out of his contract with Tommy Dorsey. And money talks, and that's why he got out of the contract. And that's what you see in The Godfather. Money talks and trumps everything.
You also managed to give a little cameo to Doris Day, who you love in the book. She shows up in a, I can't remember, someone loves her. One of your relatives loves her.
My mother really loved Doris Day. So, and that was, I wanted to look at the fact of, you know, there's my father, who, of course, was very Italian on both sides, and his attraction to the Italian culture. My mother, who was very English, and but contrary to stereotypes, very warm and giving. And the fact that my mother, when we went to see The Godfather, did not like the movie at all. And I just thought it was sort of emblematic of the two sides of my family. My mother loved Doris Day, to get back to your question, but when we sat in the movie, and I was, of course, engrossed, as was my father, my mother kept leaning over and saying, when is this going to be over?
You know, you mention in the movie, in the book, it's not a movie yet, you mention in your book that men love The Godfather more than women do. I talked to my wife about that, and she goes, no, I mean, that may be true, but... For her, what she loves about The Godfather is she loves the sweeping saga of a family. She's not as interested in the gunplay.
Right, right. Well, it's, you know, one critic at the time of the release very smartly called it the Italian-American Gone with the Wind.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, which speaks to your wife's response. But I think I still feel men are more passionate about it. I will stand by that statement. And I think part of that, Gary, is the fact that when The Godfather and Part 2 came out in 72 and 74, respectively. So 72, we have the height of Vietnam, and 74, we have Watergate. And so the world in America was turned so upside down, and there you have Don Corleone, a world of certainty, you know, cause and effect and taking care of business, and that was enormously appealing. And in terms of the male perspective, if you look at the films, they're really speaking to the vanishing culture of the white male in control of American society, and that was all changing. So there's a very nostalgic connection on the part of men to it, and that's one of the reasons.
Well, let me just ask you about the book. Did you recently reread the book as you were doing research in this book?
Oh, definitely. That was one of the first things I did, because I thought, well, that's where it all started. Let me sit down and just read the book straight through.
And so I read it a long time ago. How much of the book... I know that part one is obviously inspired by the book, but part two, how much of that is in the book?
Well, the thing that's easy to forget is that all of the material that we see in part two about Vito in Italy, mm-hmm. that exists in the book. What does not exist in the book and was created for the screen and done so brilliantly are all the extended sequences when Michael goes to Cuba and is setting up the mob connections there right before the Castro Revolution. All of that was completely invented for part two.
I also want to ask about the music. I love the music in the film. I think it's so, it's such a part of the film, as it is, as good film music often is. And the absence of music in certain scenes is really key, like in the scene where all you hear is the noise of a elevated subway.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about the music.
Well, it is a key component, that fabulous score by Nino Rota. And as soon as you hear those opening notes, you know you are going back in time, and that it has a very elegiac sound to it. And it's so smartly done because you have the Godfather theme, and then when Don Vito is shot and Michael is goes to the hospital and he prevents the assassination, a second attempt, and he says to his father, he leans over the bed and he says, "It's okay, Pop, I'm here. I will take care of things." And what happens musically is you hear a new theme that plays off of the old one, and it's called The New Godfather. So all of these subtle elements that come in are, really beautifully done. And then there are not the background scoring, but the pieces of incidental music, like when Michael is in Italy and about to be married, and those were composed by Francis Ford Coppola's father. So that gave it another element of the familial to the film.
There's a scene in Godfather Part II that's set in the past, in the prequel sequences, I guess we'll call them. And there's some musicians that are playing on the street, and they are playing one of the themes.
Right.
It's kind
of, that's great that you noticed that.
I love that. I'm not sure which theme it is, but one of the
themes. They do. You're right. Absolutely. I think the score is so brilliant, and the way Coppola uses sound, even if it's not music, but just the sound of right before he orders the strangling of his brother-in-law Carlo, the only sound you hear is the crunching of the shoes on the pebbled driveway right before it happens. You know, all those little things that add up, that heighten the tension, and I felt the only use of sound that Coppola missed was, this was an Italian-American epic, there should have been the sound of rosary beads clicking against each other.
In your book, you talk quite a bit about the legacy of The Godfather, since it's called The Godfather Effect. Obviously, you know, you can see that effect in The Sopranos, but you even think that Snooki shows some of the Godfather effect.
God help us all. I really think, sadly. Well, it's that what I'm really saying about Snooki and everybody on Jersey Shore is that this now is the most famous representation of Italian-American culture on television today. And whereas in The Godfather, they may have been mobsters, but they were full human beings. We're now back to caricatures. You know, to me, Snooki and the castmates are just the 21st century representation of the organ grinder with his monkey, which is the Uncle Tom symbol of Italian Americans. And it's so distressing to me that we've come full circle with them on the screen. And I was really interested that when in the last season of the epic Jersey Shore, when they all went to Italy, a return to roots, and of course acted like buffoons over there, and on the first day ran into a police car and things like that, the Italian press was all over them. But the Italian press, of course, was not saying, look at these Italian Americans, as they do here. The press was saying, look at these boorish Americans, super caffoni, buffoons, and that's our image overseas in Italy.
We're talking with Tom Santapietro. His newest book, and all of his books are great, and you should go get them all, but his newest one is called The Godfather Effect, Changing Hollywood, America and Me. Tom Santapietro is also the subject of a neat little profile in the New York Times a year ago. You could look it up and read it because it's fascinating. And Tom Santapietro, thank you so much for spending some time with us again on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much, Gary, for having me on.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes or Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Tom Santapietro, for being here this week. His book is called The Godfather Effect, Changing Hollywood, America, and Me. Production assistance on From the Bookshelf is provided by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.